ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Dr. Ann Jones here. I've been out and about recording nature sounds, but nature doesn't always oblige. For example, this wombat, yes, you, thought that my recorder was the perfect place to scratch its butt. So to find out what else that wombat got up to one night near Canberra, subscribe to Nature Sounds by Ann Jones on ABC Listen, on podcast apps, and also on the Wombat Butt Scratching Thumbs Up list.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is The Law Report on ABC Radio National. Coming up, would an international treaty help the global community better respond to natural disasters like the recent earthquakes in Colombia and Venezuela?
There is currently no international framework for cooperation in disasters. It's often ad hoc and improvised.
First, the criminal trial of former radio broadcaster Alan Jones has begun in the local court in Sydney. Jones faces multiple allegations that he indecently assaulted, groped or inappropriately touched a number of young men. The 85-year-old has pleaded not guilty to all charges against him. His trial is being heard by a judge. There is no jury. Rixa, Emeritus Professor in Law and Criminal Justice at Adelaide University, has been following the case and he joins me now. Rick, why is this trial attracting so much attention?
As your listeners would know, Damien, Alan Jones is a very famous and long-time radio announcer and journalist and commentator. He courted lots of prime ministers over his time, so he's very, very well known. And of course, everyone is intrigued by this particular series of events, as alleged, because obviously he's a very high-profile person.
He was a very powerful figure. He turned 85 in April. Rick, what are the charges against Alan Jones and how many complainants are there in this trial?
Well, there were a number and they ultimately were brought down to six, and there were 22 charges, most of them, 20 of them in relation to indecent assault and a couple in relation to unlawful touching. So they're all to do with sexual offences, which of course, once again, if you're talking about media attention, that always tends to attract a lot of interest.
And when and where did these alleged offences take place?
At the apartment that Alan Jones owned, or still owns, near Circular Quay, and also down at Fitzroy Falls, where he had a country house. And I think there's some evidence of the most recent witness, Witness J, or the first one to be examined and then cross-examined, that there may have been something happening in a car. But at the very least, we know there have been a lot of allegations made over at least two sites.
And what is the prosecution case?
Well, the prosecution case is that Alan Jones inappropriately touched at least one, because we've only heard evidence from one complainant so far. But there will be six persons brought before the courts, and it's not unlikely this will go for some weeks. And the allegation simply being that you can't touch a person without their consent. But the allegation is that these six people were indecently assaulted or touched inappropriately.
So one of the complainants, a man known only as Jay, has given his evidence and also been cross-examined. From the evidence and from the cross-examination of this one witness so far, what have we learned about the defence case?
Well, that's right. No one ever really knows what the defence case is going to be until the line of questioning and cross-examination. And the line of questioning and cross-examination is very, very clear. The defence case is it simply did not happen, certainly in relation to Jay. We don't know about the others. But sometimes in these instances, there will be maybe a defence that, yes, there was some touching, there was, you know, some behaviour which has been alleged, but it was done with the consent of the complainant. In this case, there's been absolutely no hint whatsoever about a question of defending on the basis of consent. The defence case is that it simply didn't happen. And in fact, they've been going very, very strong and hard on the inconsistencies or the apparent inconsistencies between what the complainant may have said in his statement to the police and what he's now saying in court.
And according to, you know, press reports, complainant Jay was a young sports person at the time who was receiving money from Alan Jones to support his sporting career. How does that passing of money over time, how does that impact on the arguments of both defence and prosecution?
The defence is going very hard on the fact that by looking back on the complainant's banking records, it appears that the payments were made, again, we're just talking about the evidence and the cross-examination, the payments were made at about the same time as this young athlete was able to do extraordinary things or win certain events. So the defence case is, yes, the payments were made, but they were rewards for Alan Jones taking this young man in his stride. And don't forget, Alan Jones was a famous rugby coach as well, so he's been around sporting events for years. And so what the defence case is, yes, the payments were made, but they're all made as a reward for his athletic prowess.
So this is a judge alone trial in the New South Wales local court. In other words, there is no jury. How did that come about and why?
It came about because in serious offences, which are referred to as indictable offences, if they are less serious indictable offences, like murders, a serious indictable offence, but a sexual offence such as this is less serious, in which case it's possible for a defendant to elect to have the matter dealt with by a judge alone in a lesser court. In this instance, the lesser court, which a lot of your listeners would know as magistrates' courts, are referred to in New South Wales as local courts. Intriguingly, local court magistrates in New South Wales are now referred somewhat confusingly as judges. So this is judge alone, but really the matter's being dealt with by a local court judge, also kind of known as a magistrate, where you can then deal with these serious indictable matters, which are less serious than the major ones, but more serious than the summary matters that your listeners would know are typically heard in magistrates' courts. So it's a somewhat strange amalgamation where you're actually hearing very serious matters before someone who is essentially a magistrate, but where there can be serious consequences if there's a finding of guilt.
And why would an accused sometimes choose to have a judge alone trial?
There are a number of advantages of having a magistrate alone or judge alone trial like this one. The first one is that the penalties are less, and a person would typically only face a penalty in relation to each of the cases of up to 2 years imprisonment. But I think it's not unlikely that a matter like this before a jury, and I like juries, I'm not suggesting juries would do the wrong thing, but there are instances and some suspicions that juries might want to say, well, I don't like Alan Jones, I don't like sexual offences, I don't care what the evidence says, I'm going to find him guilty anyway. So what the defence is relying upon is someone as clever as a judge, in this case Glenn Walsh, to ensure that he will only listen to matters before him which are directly in relation to the evidence that's before him. And also it actually would be a lot less timely. You start impaneling juries and have juries go in and out in relation to admissibility of evidence, etc. This may be a 6 or 7 week trial. With a jury, it might take 8 or 9 weeks. So I'm assuming the prosecution has agreed to this, and I'm sure that's because this will in some way shorten the trial, make it a lot faster, and the matters which are of a defence relationship would be far more easily explained and accepted by a judge than perhaps a jury.
When you say that the sentences would be less, that's because it's being heard in the local court, or because just the nature of the charges, regardless of whether they're heard in the local court or the district court?
No, it's because they're being heard in the local court. So the local court hears matters which are less serious, and in those circumstances, if you're talking about imprisonment, the imprisonment can only be for up to 2 years in relation to each of the counts.
Rick, how common are judge-alone trials in New South Wales, and are they an option in all Australian jurisdictions?
I understand from looking at the figures that in the last decade or so, judge-alone trials, whether it's in this local court level or in the district court level, or in the Supreme Court for that matter, are about 1 in 5 are held before a judge alone. People do like the idea of juries, and I think I understand why that's the case. You're being judged by your peers, and you can appeal to a jury, particularly in relation to matters which are, I think, outside of a sexual relationship. But yes, about 1 in 5, and I think that's probably around the country would be very similar. But they're not held in every state, and they're not held in relation to federal offences because the somewhat out-of-date constitution that we have in trying to protect people said we should have jury trials for all criminal matters which are more serious, without recognising, of course, that having the option of a jury trial is actually supposed to help a defendant. But the wording in the Australian Constitution is very clear. So in relation to federal offences, they cannot be judge alone, and in fact can't be judge alone in the ACT or Victoria. for whatever reason, but they certainly have them in New South Wales.
Is there any evidence or research on the differences in outcomes between judge alone and jury trials?
There is a bit of research, but the most recent research is more than 10 years old, so we really can't rely too much upon it, and it's a bit ambiguous as well. There is some research evidence going over a decade, going back to the early part of the 2000s, where judge alone trials were far more likely to give rise to an exoneration and acquittal. But I'm not sure that's particularly reliable, because there's evidence in other studies that that's not the case. And in fact, we simply don't know the breakdown between whether that's the case in sexual offences or sexually alleged offences or, you know, violent offences or fraudulent offences, etc. So I'm not sure that we can make too much of that. I'd like to see another study done. And what's interesting about having a judge alone trial, of course, Damien, is that the judge then can't just dismiss the jury, hear a matter and bring the jury back in again. The judge has to hear the evidence himself to determine whether or not he should take it into account when he's making a finding in relation to the reliability of the evidence of the witness in relation to the matter before the court. So that interesting thing when you've got a judge alone, that the judge has to make those calls on what it is that he hears, even if he's heard it, and what, of course, then arranges in his mind, if he doesn't want to hear it, when he gives his verdict at the end of the day, after all the trials are out, he'll say, I'm not taking into account this particular matter, because it's not evidence, which is an interesting thing. It's one of those things you have when judge alone hears matters of admissibility.
Very interesting. So the idea is that judges are able to do that. They're able to make those sorts of assessments and then, if needs be, not consider that evidence when they're making findings of facts, when they're coming to determine a finding of guilt or not guilt.
Precisely. We have to put our faith in judges that they're capable of doing that.
Rick, finally, what happens next? There's a long way to go in this trial, isn't there?
There is a long way. There are six complainants, and we've taken an entire week to look at the first of them. So one can assume that when people said this trial could take between 6, 7, and 8 weeks, we can understand why, because the next complainant will come forward. He will be examined and then cross-examined. I should say all of the complainants are giving their evidence remotely, beaming in from another place, not actually in the courtroom. And of course, there's all the business about how that's going to occur as well, and that takes time. But one can assume there's another five witnesses, so we're here for the long haul.
Emeritus Professor in Law and Criminal Justice at Adelaide University, Rick Saar, thank you. Thank you for speaking to The Law Report.
My pleasure, Damien.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National and available as a podcast anytime on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Offers of international assistance quickly follow natural disasters like the recent earthquakes in Colombia and Venezuela. But how effectively is that assistance deployed? Well, next month in New York, the United Nations General Assembly is expected to receive a new draft of a treaty on how the global community can better respond to large-scale disasters. Dr. Thomas Mulder, based at the University of New South Wales, is the author of a new book, Solidarity in International Disaster Response Law. Thomas, what gap in international law is this treaty trying to fill, and how have we seen that gap in the response to the devastating twin earthquakes that hit Venezuela in June?
So this treaty responds to a growing need for international cooperation in disasters. Due to climate change, experts are expecting a rise of 40% in disasters by 2030 compared to 2015. And many people are dependent on international aid following disasters that overwhelm local capacity. So international cooperation is a growing need. But the problem is that there is currently no international framework for cooperation in disasters. So there is currently an international response. We've seen that recently in Venezuela, but it's often ad hoc and improvised. And this treaty is seeking to fill that gap, basically by setting some rules of the road on how states can cooperate in responding to major disasters that overwhelm local response authorities and capacities, where there is a clear need for international aid to help people in great need.
And focusing in on Venezuela, what have we seen in terms of what's worked and what hasn't worked and what the problems have been?
Well, the recent earthquake in Venezuela is a good example. The international response was quite immediate and also quite substantial, I think. Many governments and international organizations like the United Nations and Red Cross, they all mobilized really quickly and they offered help to the Venezuelan government. So the problem isn't really international goodwill, I don't think. It's more about making sure that international aid reaches the people who need it most. What we've seen, for example, in Venezuela is that there was an influx of international aid. But at the same time, we also see in more remote villages that residents were still digging for survivors from the rubble with their bare hands. And weeks later, some families are still living in tents or in makeshift shelters, waiting for help that never really came. And this treaty is about establishing rules and principles to make sure that international aid in response to disasters is not ad hoc and reactive and improvised, but that it becomes more of a predictable and effective process to make sure that international aid, when it is offered, that it also reaches the people who need it most.
And what sorts of issues have we seen in Venezuela? I mean, are there issues around aid getting into the country, or is it around aid getting to the most affected communities? Is it about the aid going to some communities and not others who might be more favoured? What are some of the issues that you see?
Yeah, it's all of the above, actually. There was a strong response from the international community. Over 70 countries offered aid to the Venezuelan government. But then sometimes aid gets stuck in that process and it doesn't get distributed well. It kind of gets tangled up in bureaucratic red tape. There are custom checks when goods arrive into a country. Relief workers often require visas that may take time to be processed. Now, that's all causing delays. But it's also a coordination issue. So some areas will receive more aid while others are ignored or simply harder to reach for a variety of reasons. And what we've also seen in the Venezuelan example or recent event is that there is a peak of international attention and a strong influx of aid in the days following, and that was much needed as well. But now the attention of the world has sort of shifted and we're moving forward to other problems when there are still really serious needs on the ground in Venezuela.
And how would a treaty help?
So this treaty will set basic rules and principles for that cooperation that can make cooperation in disaster response more predictable. It can clarify the rules and responsibilities. It promotes preparedness for states to both send and receive aid. And it can ensure that responses are people-centered, that respect human rights and uphold human dignity.
There have been in the past disasters where governments have actually refused international assistance. I'm thinking back to Myanmar, and I think it was Cyclone Nargis in 2008. And the military rulers actually refused any international assistance, didn't they? So that's a kind of an extreme example of a state where a disaster's taken place, which have acted in a way totally contrary to the best interests of their own citizens.
Yes, that's right. That's one extreme example. Now, luckily, in most instances, governments are open to receiving international aid. But yes, in the event that there are political blockades to international aid, that is something that this treaty also seeks to respond to. It establishes rules on and obligations for states on when they should seek international assistance and also accept that. And what it basically says is that states must accept international aid when its own national capacities are overwhelmed.
And is it also a way of underlining that assistance should go to those who need it? I know sometimes in some disasters there have been allegations that certain groups and certain communities within affected countries don't receive assistance. Maybe they're members of a particular ethnic minority or a particular political group.
That's right. And there are already rules on that, of course, under international human rights law. It's prohibited to discriminate, including in the distribution of humanitarian assistance. And that will be affirmed as again in this draft treaty. And I think that will be good for relief organizations and workers who are active in the ground to have something, have a legal instrument to go back to make an argument to the government to say, hold on a moment, we have all committed to making sure that humanitarian assistance is provided on a neutral basis, on an independent basis, and without discrimination.
And where have those sort of question marks been raised? In what sorts of disasters? Can you give me some examples?
It's happened in Myanmar a few times where the government has seemingly obstructed humanitarian aid reaching certain communities. And it also happened in the 2023 earthquake in Turkey and Syria, where back then the Syrian government, the Assad government, was preventing international humanitarian organizations from accessing certain rebel-held territory that was heavily affected by that earthquake in northern Syria.
Can there also be concerns about the actions of countries that have resources and are sending those resources to disaster-affected states? What are the questions there? What are some of the issues on that side of the equation?
So, like I said, a lot of states and a lot of countries are willing to help, especially when the needs are so immense. But they also may face bureaucratic barriers when they're trying to get equipment and relief workers into these disaster-affected places, but first need to fill out a number of forms to get that done. That's blocking their efforts as well. So having rules around that and around facilitating that international cooperation and the influx of that aid can also massively help the donor countries, the countries that are willing to help.
And under this proposed treaty, would there be an obligation on the one hand to accept aid and on the other hand an obligation to offer assistance?
The obligation to accept assistance would only arise in extreme situations where national capacities are completely overwhelmed and where it's clear that international aid is necessary to help the affected population. But the treaty does not establish a sort of corresponding obligation to also provide that aid by other states. But I also don't think that that is the major problem. We do see that a lot of countries are often willing to offer aid and to send that. It's more about making sure that the rules and responsibilities are clear around that and that states are prepared for that level of international cooperation when every minute counts.
Sometimes disasters coincide with wars or conflicts. Would this treaty be able to address those situations, or are they just all in the too hard basket?
The short answer would be that this treaty does not apply to situations of armed conflict. That is covered by a different body of international law, international humanitarian law, that does have similar rules on when to seek international assistance and whether to accept it or not. But I do think that there is still an advantage here, because by developing a preparedness for international aid that can also facilitate international assistance in the context of armed conflict.
What's the position of the USA and of China on this treaty?
It's not completely clear where the US stands on this treaty today. They've been quite supportive in the process of developing this draft over the last two decades. But it's not quite clear what the position of the US is under the Trump administration. China has also been quite supportive of this treaty, but has flagged some concerns around those obligations on seeking and accepting international aid and the importance of state sovereignty there. But they acknowledge that disasters is a growing concern internationally, and they're very much open to negotiating a treaty on this.
What would a treaty mean for Australia?
So Australia is a very active player in disaster response, particularly in the Pacific region and also in Southeast Asia, where we are one of the states that offers international assistance quite regularly where that is needed. So again, it's about, I think, two things. First, this treaty would provide a foundation to develop those partnerships more in the region. Recently, Australia presented a new treaty with Vanuatu, that also covers cooperation in the context of disasters. So this treaty can be a foundation for that and can establish sort of a framework within which we can see those relationships develop further. And the other thing is that being better prepared for disaster response will also enable Australia and its partners to offer aid where that is needed, and vice versa, because Australia actually also receives international aid. No country on earth is isolated from disasters. And we work together with New Zealand, Canada, USA, for example, in bushfire relief.
Currently, Australian aerial firefighting crews are based in France to combat the bushfires in the country's south. So this sort of cooperation goes both ways.
That's right.
Because listeners might imagine that high-income or highly developed countries don't often need international assistance, but that's not the case, is it, Thomas?
No, it's not. No country is insulated from disasters. And there are a whole range of examples of wealthy developed states that have received international assistance. Australia has in the Black Summer, or the Black Summer fires. But also think of New Zealand in the aftermath of the Christchurch earthquakes. And even the US after Hurricane Katrina, they also received international aid to help people who were in need and affected by those disasters.
So will the treaty, if it goes ahead, sort of just contain a series of kind of bullet points around visas, around levies, around access, around distribution, identifying what the blockages can be and saying this is the way they should be addressed, this is the way aid should get through?
So this treaty will really be a first step in that direction. It's envisaged to be quite a high-level treaty that sets out basic rules and principles around international cooperation in disasters. And that's needed because there is no treaty of that kind right now. So it's filling that gap. But then the hard work will still need to be done after that. Most of these issues that we've been talking about really depend on states and countries being prepared themselves, having legal frameworks in place, having coordination mechanisms in place that can facilitate that international assistance when the time comes. Now, that's harder work that will need to be done later in the implementation of this treaty, but this treaty really is that first step into that direction.
And that's in the Philippines, I think, in January next year.
Yes.
Dr. Thomas Mulder, based at UNSW, the author of a new book called Solidarity in International Disaster Response Law. Thank you. Thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
Thank you so much.
That's all we've got time for. Do follow the Law Report on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and also to audio producer Elise Simons. Next week, we'll bring you the first in a four-part special series on wills and succession. It's called Over My Dead Body. And episode one focuses on fraud and undue influence.
The difficulty often is proving it. These things happen behind closed doors.
That's Over My Dead Body, which starts here next week on The Law Report. I'm Damien Carrick. Join me then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.